Hello, I'm Crystal. I'll be your tour guide. Welcome to Princeton University, 1964. Today you will be walking as two gentlemen. First, a young high school sophomore from Trenton in the Princeton Summer Studies program. Second, an ethnographer hired to observe, study, and keep copious notes on the young males that made up the PSSP program. On this walk, you will experience a loss of innocence and gain a sense of self-awareness. Please proceed toward Wilcox Hall. If you need help finding it, press pause and ask for directions. Now, first, you are a black teenage male in the PSSP program named Harlan Joseph. You are here because you are a culturally disadvantaged youth selected from Trenton Central High School. To be this young is to be wide-eyed and wearing a coat of innocence that will shed and be replaced by a coat of involuntary, speculative awareness. In order to shed that coat, a magnificent event must occur. For every young person, there is an event that makes you realize that you are part of society and you have the potential to be more than a spectator. After this event, you are tempted to find a space and renovate it just for yourself, your own identity, wants, and desires. Motivated by anger, love, desperation, or curiosity. For my sister, it was the unjust firing of her beloved high school principal that made her lead her fellow classmates out of school and onto the track in protest. The students of Trenton Central High School did something similar. They had an established route from their high school to the courthouse that they marched when necessary. For me, it was the election of a demagogue as president, or maybe the slaughter of 18-year-old Michael Brown the month I began my freshman year of college. For some of you, it might have been the Vietnam War, invading Iraq, or apartheid, but I won't put words in your mouth. You know the event that changed you. For Harlan Joseph, it was the barbershop incident. Hank Ganges, Walter Bullock, Tom Ainsworth, and Carl Jones, who wrote to Town Topics, published August 6, 1964, said this is what happened. To the editor of Town Topics, 40 high school sophomores were chosen throughout New Jersey to attend a special education program at Princeton University. We are members of this Princeton Summer Studies program. On July 18th, some of us in the program went into town to get haircuts. We stopped at Frank's Barbershop on Witherspoon Street. Our group was part white and part Negro. When we went into the shop, Frank told the Negro boys that he did not have the right kind of clippers to cut their hair. He explained that their hair was wiry and would hurt his blades. He suggested that they go down the street to a colored barbershop. The group went to the Nassau Barbershop nearby. The same clippers used there for white customers were also used for the Negro boys in our group. On the following Saturday, July 25th, a similar incident occurred at Frank's. Two Negroes in the program were asked to leave the shop because they did not have an appointment. Frank said that he was booked until the following Wednesday. Tom Ainsworth, a local white boy in the program who was at the shop at the time, offered his place to one of the Negro boys. Frank said, "We don't work that way." Professor Sheldon Judson, director of the summer student projects on campus, witnessed the incident while he was getting a haircut. He had no appointment. Later on, Dr. McCracken, coordinator of the Princeton Summer Studies program, and Kurt Noel, a Negro counselor, went to Frank's shop because they were concerned about the incidents. Kurt was refused a haircut. When he asked for a shave, Frank told him that he does not give shaves to his customers. Kurt then asked if it was because he was black. "We think so. From the evidence that we are certain that Frank is guilty against discrimination of Negroes. And we are disgusted. We still don't believe it could happen here in a New Jersey city in 1964, especially Princeton." Princetonians are said to be proud of their town and their university, but do they have the facts? We believe that injustices such as these should be acted upon, and we are writing to your paper for results. All residents of Princeton should be aware of this problem, and we hope act against it. The editor's note following the young men's article stated, "I honestly do not know how to cut Negroes' hair," said Frank Landolfi, owner of the barbershop, in commenting on the letter. He says that he did not refuse to cut boys' hair, but merely told them that he did not know how and did not have the special tools which he had been told were necessary. "It isn't that I'm against them," said Mr. Landolfi, "but because I don't know how to do the cutting, it would take me longer, and my white customers would have to wait, and they might get tired of waiting and go somewhere else." In a Town Topics published the following week, on August 13th, in an article titled, "Barbers Say Yes to Continue Policy." All Princeton barbers have agreed to continue their policy of cutting the hair of any male who properly presents himself for a haircut. The policy announcement was made after Mayor Henry S. Patterson and the barbers met in conference. Mayor Patterson had invited all Princeton barbers to meet with him after he had received a letter charging one barber shop with discrimination against Negro customers. Immediately after he read the letter, Mayor Patterson said he called the PAHR office, talked with Thomas Caldwell of PAHR, and discussed with him the plan to call a barbers' conference. PAHR had been considering the possibility of a demonstration, Mayor Patterson said. "The barbers told me that they never had discriminated and did not plan to in the future," Mayor Patterson said, and the barber involved in the letter subscribed to the policy statement. "I commend the barbers and PAHR for their sense of community responsibility," Mayor Patterson continued. "The barbers were delighted to help if they could and to correct any misunderstandings. The objective was to correct the problem, not to demonstrate for the sake of demonstrating. And PAHR's awareness of this shows a responsible attitude." There are 12 barbershops in the borough of Princeton. 3 are in the Witherspoon John area and serve mostly Negro customers. In the policy statement, "properly presents" is interpreted to mean that a man is sober. For every young person, there is an event. Society will tell you what you are and why they cannot accommodate you. This barbershop incident was a catalyst for Joseph, who later wrote to Dr. McCracken, "I looked at civil rights this way. 1. I knew discrimination was dead wrong. 2. I knew that I didn't like it. 3. But I was only involved indirectly. What I mean is that I've never been discriminated against personally. The classwork that I did before attending the farm was when I was at Princeton, and we had to do something about that barbershop. But then again, I was only involved in an indirect sense. Please proceed toward the U store. If you need help finding it, press pause and ask someone who looks like they know where they are going." Harlan Joseph would die in Trenton, April 1968, during riots that followed the MLK assassination. He was 19 and home from Lincoln University. He aspired to become a pastor. Youth is participating in the world indirectly. Adulthood is just the opposite. Youth is shorter than adulthood. This is adulthood. Now you are the historian, Preston R. Wilcox, an ethnographer hired to keep meticulous notes on the black males in the PSSP. These are your observations from your report, What It Means to Be a Negro in Princeton. The importance of recording these happenings is in the hope that they may give some insight on how a Negro student can expect to be treated when he attends school at Princeton University. What I am doing here is listing a series of incidents which I feel had some bearing on the fact that the historian is a Negro. On June 29, 1964, when I arrived in Princeton, New Jersey, at the building where I now reside, the Hibbins Apartments, I was greeted by one of the workers in the building with the question, "Are you still playing basketball?" The historian, who is a former basketball player, knew that his answer was no. But at the same time, he was wondering how this particular person knew that he had played basketball. The historian answered, "No." And then was approached very warmly by the worker, who explained that he thought the historian was Goose Tatum, a former star of the Harlem Globetrotters. The next incident refers to a series of contacts which the historian has had as a tenant in the building mentioned above. As he meets more and more people, it is obvious that they immediately know that he lives in apartment 5E and that he is working as a historian in the PSSP. Earlier Earlier, he had mentioned this to some of the people from Princeton he had met, and the word had gotten around. He is usually greeted with warm enthusiasm, sometimes not appropriate to the particular situation. Also, the interest in the PSSP program is unusually high, particularly for people who don't really understand what the function and purpose of this program is. The historian's opinion is that the program elicits a great deal of emotional feeling, which is often suppressed in order to hide the ill feeling of many of the people who discuss the program with him. Incident number 3 related to the situation that occurred in the A&P in the Princeton Shopping Center. The historian was looking at the watermelon in the first section when he was called over by an elderly lady who said, "There are some watermelons on this side of the table." The historian walked around and she immediately asked him whether or not the melon she was about to buy was a good one. She said, "I hope you will tell me the truth, because if it is not a good watermelon, my husband will make me bring it back." The historian never had a chance to answer, but he assumed it was a good watermelon. It was good to know that I was expected to be a connoisseur of this fruit. Incident number 4. On one occasion, the historian asked Mrs. Broadway, one of the ladies who works in the Wilcox dining room, the price of the meals. He wanted to know so he could keep record of how much it was going to cost him at the end of the year. Mrs. Broadway went to Norman Mills, in charge of the dining room, to ask him the price. When she came back to me, she reported, "Since the civil rights situation, he's been acting awfully funny, so he suggested that you come ask him yourself." The historian noted that Mrs. Broadway is one of the only Negro workers in the dining room who wears a name tag, and who uses the title Mrs. before her name. The other Negro help have signs on them listing their first names only. Incident number 5. The historian has attempted to get to know the help who work around Wilcox Hall. He is impressed with the fact that most of them shy away from him, and most of them have reluctantly shaken hands with him. Most of their handshakes are like a wet dish rag. On one occasion, he heard them kidding each other about being from Africa. When he asked the question, "What is wrong about being from Africa, since this is where our original roots are?" they sort of sheepishly walked away. Incident number 6. On one occasion, about 6 p.m., the historian was standing in the lobby of Wilcox Hall when two members of the Princeton community walked in and began questioning him about the use of rooms and how they could obtain them, and whether or not they would be used during the hours they wanted them, etc. It so happened that the historian never had a chance to respond, since the two people were asking questions and sort of thinking aloud and answering some questions themselves. They then thanked the historian very much and said they would call up later to find out some of the questions they had asked him. It was the historian's assumption, they assumed, that he was the custodian in the building. Incidents number 7 and 8. Two of the student counselors, John Williams and Javier Johnson, have shared with the historian their opinions of what it means to be a Negro at Princeton University. Javier talked about having arrived here expecting to be able to establish easy relationships with other students, since they were sharing a common effort to achieve educational competence. He found, however, that he had to deal with most students almost on an individual basis. He found that every time he sort of set himself on dealing with everybody on the same basis, he would often be set back by someone who would raise a loaded question or make certain types of assumptions about him. He also pointed out that one of the first things he did was buy a Princeton sweater and to make sure that he was treated as a townie, as against a gownie. John Williams talked about the fact that he had a difficulty getting into the gym when he first came as a student. It seems the automatic assumption was that he was not a student. Incident number 9. On a day early in my experience here, I visited the university store in order to cash a check. The historian was totally impressed with the expeditious manner in which they handled the cashing of his check. In fact, they almost failed to check his identification. They were so anxious to cash the check. Their sincere interest in me sort of shocked me, because the normal procedure is not to cash checks unless one is pretty sure of the person for whom they cash a check. please proceed towards the Lewis Center. If you need help finding it, press pause and ask for help. On the same day, I was browsing in the bookshop and noted that there was one Negro employee. She came over to me and asked if she could be of any help. In fact, all of the white help ignored me, as they did the other people who were in the bookshop. My assumption is that the Negro employee, who probably does not see any Negroes in the bookstore, sort of went out of her way to make sure that I was comfortable in the store, but I still don't appreciate it. Incident number 10. On July 16, 1964, the historian was standing on the sidewalk in back of the building where he lives, and a delivery man came up looking for the superintendent about some work he had done. It was obvious that he made the assumption that the historian was part of the custodial help in the building. Incident number 11. On a given day during the week of July 13, 1964, the historian walked into the dining room and saw Javier Johnson, John Williams, and Kurt Noel sitting together. He immediately chided them for sitting together. In the historian's mind was the fact that there were three counselors sitting together when they should have been mingling with students. Javier said to me, "There's another point you could also make." The historian thought for a moment, then he finally caught on. Three Negro counselors were sitting together. Other reports of the counselors will no doubt deal with questions that relate to the same issue. If one could make a generalization about the experience of a Negro in Princeton, the strongest generalization is the tendency of people to, in a sense, ignore differences. This ignoring of differences is almost like a non-reaction. What I am suggesting is that it seems that people make such a deliberate effort to ignore differences that it is obvious that they do recognize differences, and sometimes recognize them as being invidious differences. For instance, on July 19, 1964, the historian had to go to New York to pick up his daughter who had just returned from Girl Scout camp. As he got on the suburban bus down at the Princeton Shopping Center, there was a newscast about the riot in Harlem, which the historian had not heard about. There was a lively discussion between the historian and other people on the bus about the riot. At no time during the discussion was there any reference to the racial implications of it or causes of it. The discussion was merely a factual reporting of what happened, with very little feeling shown. The historian cannot recall having discussed such an issue with a strange group of people without in some way having feeling revealed. In fact, the historian noted that as he discussed with them, there was very little feeling on his part, which suggests that the response of the Princetonians is effective to a degree. Except, however, it tends to somehow avoid the real issues from the historian's standpoint. The historian plans to keep a running account of such occurrences throughout the program. One final incident should be recorded. This occurred during a faculty meeting on Wednesday, July 15, 1964. Bill Meredith was reporting that there were four students in his class who were the ones who demonstrated the poorest use of language and the least ability to articulate adequately. He referred to them as JBs, meaning jet blacks, and said they were the most Negro of all the Negro students. He talked about their use of slang, and Mac McCracken intervened to say that he had learned some slang from them. Mac revealed some sensitivity, both about hearing the comments by Bill Meredith and also in responding to the comments as he did. Bill Meredith revealed almost no feeling about what he was saying. The historian commented only that one of the boys is the one who has spent a great deal of time teaching hep talk to the counselors. End of dictation on A Negro in Princeton, transcribed by L.D. Bayless, August 3, 1964. Thank you for walking with me. Before you end your visit today, please head to the viewing room on the third floor. We'd love to get your opinion on the watermelon.